The report suggests that the governor testified falsely about that day. It suggests that when the governor said others were present, including maybe up to 10 staff members in the mansion, the report just discredited him. But I now know that they did not bother to get the records in the email that reflected who was in the mansion that day. In fact, the documents prove that the governor testified truthfully. Numerous staff were present, including Ms. Melissa DeRosa, Stephanie Benton, and Peter Zimian. And the staff that is around there all throughout the day helping out with various things within the mansion. Ms. Camisa was there for 3 hours. She was there to work on a speech. She wasn't there to fix a technical issue with the governor's phone, which is what she told the Times Union. And Ms. Camisa said that at some point during this day that the governor shut the door so hard, and then groped her, that she thought for sure someone must think, hey, what's going on? Did they hear that? The Attorney General's investigators did not ask the witnesses who were in the mansion that day about what they heard and what they saw. And during the governor's testimony on July 17th, the investigators told the governor unequivocally, that this occurred on November 16th. So why not ask the people that were there? Ask yourselves that question and whether this report was meant to be thorough and fair and to give everyone a balanced view to draw conclusions for themselves. The report also states, and the Attorney General has stated, that Ms. Camiso's claim of a sexual assault on November 16th or November 25th, or with another day in November, was independently corroborated. And that's not true. The only corroborated fact is that she first made her claim in March after the investigation began. The independent corroboration corroborates the governor. The simultaneous emails and documents corroborates Governor Cuomo. There was also testimony by several witnesses about potential motives and what was going on with Ms. Camiso in late 2020 and early 2021, and concerns she had about her job, that she had been turned down for a raise, and concerns that there was a possibility that because her work hours might change, she could be transferred. That was not reflected in the Attorney General's report. Another aspect to the Attorney General's report deals with a referral to the Albany Police Department about Ms. Camiso's claims. Now, I'm sure a lot of you have seen over the last several days that Ms. Camiso made a complaint to Sheriff Appel, the Albany County Sheriff. Well, what no one is talking about is that it was actually the executive chamber that referred Ms. Camiso's complaint when she first made it, when she was out with friends for drinks on March 6th, and then a lawyer called the executive chamber on Monday, March 8th. And when that lawyer called to make the allegation, the lawyer indicated that he did not want to pursue this criminally. But it was the executive chamber that referred the allegation to the Albany Police Department. And as further evidence of the bias of this report, look at page 147, buried in footnote 1,239. The report won't even credit the executive chamber for this. It said, quote, "We understand that certain criminal authorities, including the Albany Police Department, have been alerted to the most egregious allegations of physical touching, including the groping of Executive Assistant One." I ask you, Why couldn't the report say the executive chamber promptly reported it to the Albany Police Department? And it's because every inference was going to be drawn against the executive chamber and Governor Cuomo. The report got key facts wrong. It omitted key evidence, and it failed to include witnesses whose testimony did not support the narrative that was clear that this investigation was going to weave from day one. And I want to talk about that. This began in December of 2020 with Lindsay Boylan. Lindsay Boylan made some tweets December 5th and December 13th that talked about her departure from the mansion and accused the governor of sexual harassment. One of the things that she said in an article she published on Medium in February, a couple months later, is that she was on a plane with the governor, and he made a comment about, hey, let's play strict poker. There were several other staff members on the flights with Ms. Boylan, and every single one of them said, that didn't happen. And after that came out, that they said that didn't happen. And one of the people on the flights was Howard Zemsky, the head of the Empire State Development Agency. And he testified that he received a disparaging message from Ms. Boylan that he found, quote, jarring and threatening. And the report mentions this, but they noticeably don't tell you what that message was. They don't include it as an exhibit. Why not? That is the equivalent of witness tampering. And if any member of the chamber or the governor himself had engaged in that conduct, that would be another 10 pages of the report, and I'm sure that I would have received another subpoena from the assembly. They also did not deliberately choose to investigate communications that occurred between Lindsay Boylan's in December 20. She first made these allegations about 2 weeks after she announced she was running for Manhattan Borough President. And in that time period, there were communications between the Attorney General's Chief of Staff, Ibrahim Khan, and Ms. Boylan's top campaign consultant, Trip Yang. There were a number of conversations about what Ms. Boylan was saying and what was going on in the campaign. One of Ms. Boylan's top media consultants resigned when she made these allegations. Did the Attorney General's investigators talk to all of those people, subpoena the records from the campaign in the same way that they have subpoenaed the executive chamber and my client for anything and everything having to do with the sexual harassment with Lindsay Boylan? The complainants needed to be scrutinized just as much as the governor in the chamber. And that didn't happen here. The investigators credited Lindsay Boylan, despite the fact that they knew she had threatened a witness to get him to change his story, and he did. And one thing that has been missing through this is that there was a signal about 7 or 8 months before Ms. Boylan made her tweets in December, a signal that she was out for some type of revenge against the governor's office. You see, Ms. Boylan had ran in a primary against Congressman Jerry Nadler. And in March of 2020, when COVID started, the governor issued an executive order which narrowed the time frame for people to get petitions so they could get on the ballot. Ms. Boylan was very unhappy about this and felt that that had been directed at her. And she sent two threatening messages to members of the governor's staff. One of them said, quote, absolutely not helpful. Please relay that while we are okay. I see what the point is here, and I'll find ways to respond. Life is long, and so is my memory, and so are my resources. Her second message, absolutely not helpful, specific response to a tragedy, but please relay that while we are okay. I see what the point is here, and I will try to find ways to respond to the message. The future is coming after. I will leave the expletive out. Miss Boylan was unhappy that the governor wouldn't support her in her campaign. She blamed the governor's office and sent these threatening texts promising retribution. And sure enough, come December, after 2 weeks after announcing her campaign, she did a series of tweets and talked about why she left the chamber. She was not honest about the circumstances of her departure. And so three memos were released because a public figure running a political campaign was making statements, misleading the public about what had happened and why she left. And the chamber felt the duty to correct that record. There were also witnesses that the Attorney General's investigators interviewed that told them that Lindsay Boylan was not to be trusted and that they did not find her credible, not just based on what had happened in the tweets, but based on their professional interactions with her when she worked in the chamber. The investigators didn't include that in the report, and they credited Ms. Boylan wholesale. What perhaps I think was most bothersome, and there was a lot, but out of interviewing 179 witnesses, the investigators made a choice not to include what a lot of people had to say. And buried at the end, at page 121, is a sentence that should scare everybody. Scare everybody if you're being accused of something, and this is all you get about what people have to say that's good about you. Here's what it said. It said a number of former and current executive chamber staff, particularly the senior staff, as well as state troopers with the protection detail, denied having witnessed or experienced any conduct by the governor that could be characterized as sexual or otherwise inappropriate. That sentence is buried at the end, and of the over 1,000 footnotes, why didn't they cite the transcripts? Why didn't they quote from those people? Did what those people have to say bear upon any of the allegations that they included? The governor deserved to have a fulsome and balanced report that laid it all out. But the report doesn't identify who the witnesses were, what they said, and what they were asked. I want to talk also about Trooper Number One. The report does corroborate that the governor supported Trooper One's transfer to his detail to increase diversity among the detail members. Please read that portion of the report at page 35, because when you read the narrative of the report, it makes it sound as though he wanted this trooper on his detail to sexually harass her, and that just was not true. There is another member of the state police that corroborated that the governor was very interested out of a detail of 60 troopers who were mostly white male to have diversity. The governor has great respect for Trooper One, and he didn't touch her in a sexual manner. None of his contact with Trooper One, or for that matter, any of the troopers, was meant in any way to be inappropriate. He does greet them. He will pat them on the back. He will pat them on the side when they're opening the doors for him coming in and out of cars. On the elevator, the trooper stands in front of him. The governor will tap the trooper on the back and say hello, particularly as he's walking out of the elevator. He has read what Trooper One had to say. And he feels very badly, and he apologizes for anything that he did that caused her to feel that way. He is sorry. With respect to Charlotte Bennett, the governor addressed in detail in his video statement on August 3rd. It is important to know that any claim that he was grooming this young woman who is a sexual assault victim or the added romantic interest in her could not be further from the truth. His experience with a very, very close family member who is about the same age as Charlotte Bennett, that provided crucial context to the conversations that he had with Ms. Bennett. The governor testified in detail about this to the Attorney General's investigators, but they did not include his detailed testimony in the report. He has and he continues to apologize to Ms. Bennett for anything that he said in the conversations that he had with her that made her feel the way that she did. He certainly did not mean that, and because of her experience and what he went through with someone very close to him, he in no way, shape, or form wanted to hurt her. There are now an other series of allegations that were in the report, and the media keeps saying 11 women, 11 women. And I watched CBS This Morning yesterday, and I thought it was actually a good interview of Ms. Camiso. I thought the interviewer was fair. But what was bothersome to me afterwards is they then had a roundtable discussion with two of the men sitting there, and they just kept pointing to 11 women. And it was quite clear to me that they didn't know what the actual claims were. And then it just gets repeated over and over again by the media when they haven't done their homework, rolled up the sleeves, and learned the facts. That's what journalists are supposed to do, not cast judgment and not give us their opinions. Let's talk about some of the other allegations. State entity employee number two. This is what the Attorney General's report included as another form of sexual harassment by the governor. This event, this photo. The governor made a joke to the doctor in the hospital gown, protected against COVID while she gave him a test. And he said in front of the whole world, "You make that gown look good." That's not sexual harassment. I don't know why that was included in the Attorney General's report, except to say it was to add another number and to make the governor look bad. There was also state entity employee number one. And what she claimed is that she was at an event with the governor. And as her photo was being taken, the governor was standing between herself and her supervisor, she claims that the governor touched her butt at the public event while the photo was taken. No pictures from that event were included in the Attorney General's report. And presumably this picture is there, and we haven't been provided with that picture. If the governor may have touched her rear end while he's got his arm around the supervisor and this woman at a public event, he certainly did not mean to do it in a way that was sexual. He takes thousands of pictures. And then it goes to another one of the women who have come forward, Miss Leah Mietis. She is not a state employee. She works for an energy company. The governor was at a public event, and he was working a grope line. There were dozens of people there. There were reporters. And she claims that as he went through the grope line, He touched the logo on her shirt, which was her energy company logo, as he was greeting her. The governor did not mean to grope her. And certainly there were pictures from this event. Those pictures haven't been provided to me, and they were not part of the Attorney General's report. But this particular instance, to say that the governor would try to grope somebody working a rope line with cameras around, he certainly would never have intended to do that. And I don't mean to take away from how this woman felt, but we do need to think about qualitatively what each of the women are saying and whether these are the types of things that are impeachable offenses. There is another allegation, and it was by analysts. And it's on the report. It starts at page 82. And she talks about being at a party and that the governor sought her out. He kissed her and then put his arm around her and took this photo. That's the photo. And that photo is included in the report as evidence of some type of sexual harassment, because Ms. List then later talks about how she was uncomfortable when she thought about this photo later on, that the governor had put his arm around her. And then she talked about her experience working with him. And the governor has said, yes, he has called people darling and sweetheart. He has had to change with the times. Yes, he hugs and he kisses his staffers. He has had to change with the times. And as he said on August 3rd, after the Attorney General's report, that he slips, and he does. But this does not rise to the level of sexual harassment or groping or fondling, as has been portrayed in the press during the feeding frenzy of the last 8 days. There is then Alyssa McGrath. And this photo was included as part of the Attorney General's report. It's a photo of the governor at a holiday party. And Ms. McGrath is wearing the black, and Brittany Camiso is on the other side. And how the report portrayed this photograph is that the governor put his hands around the rib cage just below their breasts, as though there was something wrong with this photo. And I just simply ask everybody to look at this. Is this something that you think is evidence of improper behavior by the governor? Yes, he joked with Ms. Camiso and Ms. McGrath. Yes, he would hug them, as he does many of his staffers. And yes, he would give them a kiss. The governor has said over and over he did not grope, he did not fondle. He understood his relationship with them to actually be what's reflected in the photo, that they liked him very much. And he did not have a sense that either of them was uncomfortable with him. There has also been made much about the selfie picture with Ms. Camiso. I was asked about it yesterday on CNN by Erica Hill. What Ms. Camiso alleged is that on December 31st of 2019, New Year's Eve, she was at the mansion, and she claims that the governor wanted to take a selfie. What the governor told the Attorney General's office is that no, he actually remembers this, and he said, Ms. Camiso asked me if she could take a selfie with me. And what Ms. Camiso is now saying is that when she took the selfie, that the governor put his hand on her butt and rubbed it for at least 5 seconds. That's what she testified to. And that she was so nervous that it became blurry, the pictures, and she had to delete them. And so they moved and sat on a couch and then took this selfie instead. I'm not going to say any more than that. For me, as a lawyer, as a former prosecutor and a former defense lawyer, I often use pictures as exhibits at trial. The governor did not violate Brittany Camiso. He did not rub her rear end before this photo. She asked for a selfie with him. I think that this picture demonstrates a comfort level and someone who wanted a selfie with the governor. And she sent this selfie to her friend, and there is a footnote. Her friend, her very good friend, Melissa McGrath, who actually said, "I'm so jealous of the picture." Then we go to this photograph, and this is also included amongst one of the 11. This was at a wedding. The governor officiated the wedding of one of his staffers. And at the wedding, he greeted this young woman, Anna Rueich, and he did put his arms around her, hands around her face. He asked her if he could give her a kiss. That is something that he does. And she clearly was not comfortable with that. He understands that. He particularly understands it when he saw this photo on the front page of the New York Times. This does not rise to the level of sexual harassment that we impeach a sitting governor. I want to talk about Caitlin. She met the governor at a reception that was sponsored or hosted by a lobbying firm. She was recommended. He was told she was a superstar. He met her at the reception. And in front of dozens of people, he joked with her. He did a dance pose. He meant no disrespect. He was thinking. You can say whether it's right, whether it's wrong, that this was fun and that he was trying to be playful. And as we now know, it doesn't always work out that way. And the governor knows that and appreciates that. And during the time that she worked for him, he did banter with her. He did ask her about her life. That is something he routinely does with his staff members. What's going on? Are you married? Do you have kids? Are you dating anybody? That's something Senator Schumer asks his staff. It's normal when you're working closely with people in political environments that are high pressure to learn about their lives. He did not mean to make her feel uncomfortable. He does the same thing with the men that work with him. He hugs them. He kisses them. And a number of them testify to that. But the investigators didn't include any of that in the report. And he asked the men about their personal lives. Didn't include any of that in the report. What happened was that from day one, it became building a case against Governor Andrew Cuomo. They started with a presumption that he had done some terrible things. And it went from there. It didn't become scrutinizing each one of the allegations, talking to everybody about what the environment was in chamber. And the governor has said and has no doubt that working for him is tough. I think people will say that going back to his time at HUD. In political environments, dealing with serious issues, you want to get the best out of people. Tempers can flare. There's high demands on getting it right. But what happened here was this investigation took every possible negative thing that could be said about the governor and they put it in. And they disregarded the positive, the things that would balance it, and the things that would undermine what some people were saying about the governor. And that's not right. The two investigators that were charged with this report certainly, and it comes through when you read it, they brought their own biases and a predisposition to this investigation and in the manner in which the report was written. Mr. Kim is a longtime former federal prosecutor in the Southern District, my old office. Mr. Kim had pursued and supervised criminal investigations against the governor for years at that office, and he actually personally interviewed him, personally interviewed Governor Cuomo in one of the criminal investigations. Of course, he brought to the table certain views about the governor, feelings he had about how the chamber operated. How could he not? And with respect to Ms. Clark, as an attorney, her practice is focused on bringing sexual harassment and discrimination lawsuits on behalf of employees. Of course, that colored how she viewed what complainants told her versus what other people told her. She could not. That was the lens they brought to the case, and those backgrounds certainly influenced how they went about the investigation and drafted this report. But what we do know is that report got facts wrong. It omitted favorable evidence that didn't support the narrative. There were 179 witness interviews, and they only transcribed, where we get the actual Q&As, 41. So what did the other 138 say? Because there are not 179 people mentioned in that report. So here's where we are. Because of what has happened since August 3rd, with the press conference and a report that there's no question in my mind was designed and meant to devastate Governor Cuomo and his chamber. And for the last 8 days, it has been a pile-on with people judging facts when they didn't have all the facts. And as we sit here today, the investigators have not provided me, the lawyer for the governor, who is being asked to give a submission to the assembly, a single transcript to allow him to respond. They haven't even given him his own. They have not responded to my letter of last week asking to get access to the evidence. And I'm willing to do it under an agreement that protects confidentiality. This is commonly done in civil matters and in criminal matters. The Assembly Judiciary Committee and the Attorney General's office have not agreed to our request for access to the evidence. And we're being asked to make a submission on behalf of the governor of the state of New York by Friday, addressing the allegations. How are we going to be able to do that in a fair and meaningful way? This hasn't been, and it's not going to be, a fair process. And in fact, the governor has been given no process. I think that women should be believed, and they should be treated fairly. I also believe that men should be believed and treated fairly. All people should be given that. And everybody should have a chance to respond. And everybody should be scrutinized with what they say by facts, context, and evidence. That hasn't happened here. Our country has a rule of law. I believe in the rule of law. Not mob mentality and not media mentality. The governor deserves to be treated fairly, and that did not happen here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time.